Welcome to the Good Dog Pod. Join us every other Wednesday when we discuss all things dogs, from health and veterinary care to training and behavior science, as well as the ins and outs of Good Dog and how our platform can help you successfully run your breeding program. Follow us and join Good Dog's mission to build a better world for our dogs and the people who love them. So I'm going to formally kick off today's presentation, which is genetic diversity and population health, with our guest, Dr. Adam Boyko, who was with us a few weeks ago to give part one of this series. So this is the final segment of this two-part series. Just a little bit more about what we're covering today. Genetic diversity is, of course, one of the most important and complicated topics in responsible breeding. I feel like that's an understatement. And today we're going to talk about how new genomic methods are reshaping the way conservation geneticists think about population health and what that means for the strategies you yourselves can use to protect and improve the genetic health for your dogs. So taking these very big overarching concepts and really whittling them down to how they could maybe apply to what you all do individually with your programs. Of course, we couldn't do this without our friends at Purina, who helped us bring this to life. Again, also, these webinars come from all of you, just letting us know what kind of topics you want to hear us cover, what you want to learn about. So please keep sending those topics our way. I know we mentioned that at the beginning of every webinar, but it is so important because we want to make sure these are as useful to all of you in your programs as possible. So please keep sharing your ideas with us whenever you think of them. And as I mentioned, we have hosted so many webinars this year already. So you can always find those in our Good Breeder Center, all of those recordings from this year and many years previously. It's really a nice library of content if you haven't had a chance to explore that already. Those are really great to watch. And before I officially pass things over to Dr. Boyko, I just want to share a little bit more about Good Dog and who we are. Good Dog is on a mission to build a better world for our dogs and the people who love them by advocating for breeders like yourselves, educating the public, and promoting canine health and responsible dog ownership. We're an online community created just for responsible breeders to connect with Good Dog applicants from all across the country and find forever homes for your puppies. We help breeders with all aspects of managing their programs, everything from getting your litters listed, marketed to buyers, communicating with those buyers, receiving payments securely with Good Dog buyers, and all of those smaller details that happen in between your litters being born and going off to their new homes. Good Dog is really here to support you every step of the way through that. We also have a number of educational resources that we offer our community, events like this. We have Good Dog courses as well on our website, health-related discounts. So those are also designed to help your programs thrive in other ways beyond just placement management. So if you're not yet a member of our community, we would love to have you join us at gooddog.com/join. That's where you can learn more about our mission and apply to join our community. And very briefly, I just want to share a little bit about Dr. Boyko in case you missed part one of this series. I just want to share a little bit about his background. Dr. Boyko is an associate professor in the Department of Biomedical and Translational Sciences at the Cornell University College of Veterinary Medicine in Ithaca, New York. Dr. Boyko's research focuses on canine genomics, including the evolution and population history of dogs, the genetics of canine traits and disease, and the role of genetic diversity and inbreeding depression on population health. And he's also the co-founder of Embark Veterinary, a dog genetic testing company, which I think many people in our community are very familiar with already. So with that, Dr. Boyko, I will pass things over to you.
Great. Thank you very much. Thank you all for joining. I hope everyone enjoyed the first webinar where we got into the nitty gritty about what is COI and how do we calculate it. I'm hoping to use today's time as an opportunity to look at COI in a couple different species and populations and then think a little more broadly about what constitutes a genetically healthy population and how COI can be used to improve breeding outcomes. So as a refresher, COI is caused by an individual inheriting identical chromosome copies from both of its parents due to the parents having a common ancestor that transmitted identical copies of the chromosomes. So traditionally, COI has been estimated with pedigrees, but with advances in genomics, it's now possible to directly survey the genome and find long stretches of homozygosity indicative of identity by descent and calculate COI from that. And so this methodology is generally the preferred one now for several reasons, not the least of which is that it can generally look farther back than the pedigree to find relatives. And this is an important thing for many dog breeds, where a 5 or even 10 generation pedigree isn't going to encompass the bottlenecks early in the founding of the breed that contribute significantly to the inbreeding tracks in each present day individual. And so this is the primary reason why, if you do a pedigree based COI estimate, you generally come up with a much lower value than a genetic COI that would be calculated through Embark or another method that's being able to look further back, you know, 10, 20, 40 generations back and calculate inbreeding tracks from that. Even if you have pedigree records going back that far, the pedigree COIs are only estimating the expected fraction of the genome that's homozygous due to identity by descent. And it's the real value is calculated by the genomic COI. And that's going to be higher or lower depending on the specific chromosomal segments that an individual happens to inherit from the parents. So pedigree is an estimate based on the expected transmission proportions, but the genomic COI is actually looking at what got transmitted. And so this has important consequences for the things that we can do. So one example is that scientists can use the actual genomic data to de-integress species where admixture had occurred. So if you look at wildcat populations around the world, a lot of the endangered populations have been integressed with DNA from domestic cats. And if you had a pedigree for these wildcats, which we don't, but if you did, you could look at it and you could look at how much domestic and wildcat ancestors they had and compute the expected ancestry proportions. But by looking at the genome and doing ancestry deconvolution, you can actually assign wildcat or domestic cat ancestry to each portion of the genome. And even if you start out with an admixed population where everyone is exactly 50% mixed, the specific parts of the genome that each individual has from each parental population is different. And so the offspring they create will vary in their ancestry proportions, even though the expected ancestry fraction calculated from pedigrees is not going to vary. So by selecting the offspring that happened to inherit a greater fraction of the wildcat genome each generation, a captive breeding program can slowly remove the domestic cat DNA from the population over the course of several generations, even though according to pedigree analysis, these cats all have 50% domestic cat ancestry. Okay. So with that out of the way, let's look at an example of a wild population and how COI was affected by changes in that population. I'm sure all of us have heard of the extinct woolly mammoth. Woolly mammoths were one of the largest land mammals ever to walk the earth and one of the iconic Ice Age species. During the last glacial maximum, northern Eurasia and Alaska were covered in glaciers, and woolly mammoths lived in much, if not all, of this region, as evidenced by the fossils that have been found there during this time period. And by studying the ancient DNA from some of these fossils, scientists can work out how the woolly mammoth was related to modern elephants and also identify genes that have undergone specific changes in the mammoth, but not in the other elephant species. These genes can be roughly grouped into various functional classes. Many of them are directly related to phenotypes that adapted woolly mammoths to Ice Age conditions. Gene enrichment pathways in woolly mammoths in these species-specific genes are different than the gene enrichment pathways in elephant-specific genes, because both of these animals had to overcome different environmental challenges in order to supply. Ancient DNA technology has come a long ways. Recently, we've had scientists being able to use CRISPR technology to insert some of the woolly mammoth-specific genetic differences in known fur genes into laboratory mice. And so we now have transgenic woolly mice that are a way to study how the genetic changes in the coats of the mammoths, you know, may have come about and what specific mutations are underlying those. Unfortunately for the woolly mammoths, the glaciers started retreating, and in their place came human hunters that were quite adept at hunting large game, even woolly mammoths. Woolly mammoth fossils from the Younger Dryas period about 12,000 years ago are found in many fewer places than they were found during the last glacial maximum. And for fossils dated between 6 and 10,000 years ago, they only come from two places. Wrangel Island, located north of Siberia, and St. Paul's Island in the Bering Sea. So here on these islands, the mammoths were protected from humans. These were uninhabited islands, so they were protected from the hunters, but they were in relatively small regions. So these islands were connected to the mainland during the Ice Age, during the time of the Bering Land Bridge, but they became islands once the glaciers melted and the sea levels rose, trapping the mammoths living there on them. When the mammoths living there became disconnected from the mainland mammoth populations, They were protected from human hunters, but they became the last surviving woolly mammoths. And they died out about 5,600 years ago on the smaller St. Paul Island and lasted until about 4,000 years ago on the larger Wrangel Island. So the last mammoths died after the first pyramids were built, which is kind of a surprising fact, at least to me. By extracting DNA from 14 Wrangel Island mammoths carbon dated to 4,300 to 9,200 years ago and comparing them to seven older Pleistocene woolly mammoths, scientists could examine the genetic changes that occurred to the mammoths on the island. So the heterozygosity of the older Pleistocene mammoths are shown in red diamonds here, and it's much higher than the heterozygosity of the younger Wrangel Island mammoths, indicating there was a severe genetic bottleneck that occurred in the mammoths on the island. Moreover, this low heterozygosity was not constant, but seemed to continue to decline over time on the island. The loss of heterozygosity was particularly acute in the MHC region, so diversity in this region is important for immunity, and it's likely the mammoths on the island may have been more susceptible to certain diseases. And moreover, the loss of heterozygosity was driven by inbreeding, with all the Wrangel Island mammoths having very long runs of homozygosity, 2 megabases or greater, and all the Pleistocene mammoths having much lower cumulative runs of homozygosity, much lower COIs, most of the runs being less than 500 kilobases long. As the mammoth population on the island was probably between 200 and 300 individuals, COI began increasing dramatically compared to what was observed in the earlier connected larger mainland populations. If we look at any chromosome, we can easily spot the difference in the runs of homozygosity in the Wrangel Island mammoths from the older outbred Pleistocene mammoths. Indeed, several mutations common in the Wrangel Island population were highly likely to confer negative phenotypic effects. So in one study, several putatively damaging mutations found in the Wrangel Island mammoths were transgenically put into mice to see what phenotypes developed. Now, it's impossible to know the degree to which one or more of these variants or the loss of MHC diversity contributed to the eventual collapse of the population, or whether some extrinsic factor like an extreme weather event wiped out the small population. But the youngest mammoth with a genome sequence lived on Wrangel Island 4,300 years ago, and the population went extinct about a dozen generations later, around 4,000 years ago. As far as we know, the first human settlement of the island came 400 years later, around 3,600 years ago. So we can see in this population that's heading towards extinction, we've got this elevation of COI that is kind of going along with this decay and this influx of deleterious mutations into the population. With small populations like Wrangel Island mammoths, we often consider using outcrosses from other populations to inject new genetic diversity into the inbred population, a concept known as genetic rescue. Obviously, there were no other mammoths left on Earth to genetically rescue them, so the Wrangel Island mammoths couldn't get rescued and eventually went extinct. But for small populations and other species, including rare dog breeds, genetic rescue is a possibility. Genetic rescue is particularly important when deleterious mutations become fixed in a population, since at that point, there's no way for selection to act to reduce the allele frequency. So I think, as we know, the Dalmatian breed was inadvertently fixed for the HUU mutation on chromosome 3 because it's linked to the Dalmatian spotting locus. So there was no way to breed out this recessive disorder since all Dalmatians were homozygous for it. And so instead, a pointer Dalmatian backcross free of the mutation was created. And over the course of many, many, many generations, Dalmatian backcrosses were created that had over 98% Dalmatian ancestry, including the Dalmatian spots, but didn't carry the HUU mutation, enabling a mini genetic rescue of Dalmatians so they're no longer destined to be at risk of HUU. Genetic rescue is not just something that happens in pedigree populations. It's also important for isolated natural populations like the gray wolves of Isle Royale. I don't know how many people are familiar with the story of the wolves on Isle Royale, but Isle Royale is about 200 square miles and is located in Lake Superior, about 20 miles from mainland Ontario. It was colonized by 2 or 3 gray wolves and was the site of an intense ecological study for 60 years as scientists looked at the dynamics between the wolf population and the resident population of moose on the island. Wolves require large hunting ranges, so even an island as large as Isle Royale, which is the fourth largest lake island in the world, can only sustain a population of about 20 to 30 wolves. As you might expect, the scientists eventually started documenting some inbreeding depression and the health and the fecundity of the wolves started to decline. Then in 1997, a mini miracle occurred, and a new wolf, a male, migrated to the island during one particularly cold winter where he could just walk across on the ice. The scientists named this male Old Gray Guy, and he watched as he sired several healthy litters of pups. However, the genetic rescue was short-lived. Within five generations, the population was nearly extinct. Old Gray Guy was the alpha wolf on the island, but he came from the diverse mainland population, and his genome had several highly deleterious recessive alleles. Because he sired all the litters for a generation, there was no avoiding the severe inbreeding depression from his genes in this already depressed population. The last wolf pup, number 175 on the pedigree, was born, deformed, and died before its first birthday. M is the Old Gray Guy at the top of the pedigree. So instead of rescuing the population, he contributed to its demise. And now, in 2018 and 2019, scientists had to translocate 19 new wolves to Isle Royale to rebuild the pack, which fortunately seems to be doing quite well, and is now up to three packs with about a dozen individuals apiece. So the reason why we're interested in coefficient of inbreeding and genetic diversity and genetic testing is that we're interested in the genetic health of the animals we create and the long-term health of our breeds. Obviously, the Wrangel Island mammoths and the Isle Royale wolves had high COIs and were not genetically healthy. But understanding genetic population health is more than just the notion of high COI equals bad and low COI equals good. For example, I think there's a common public misconception that some breeds are healthy and other breeds are unhealthy just because there are certain conditions that are more prevalent in some breeds than others. But of course, all breeds have certain conditions, are going to have specific diseases that are relevant for their breed and less relevant for other breeds. And even in the most genetically healthy populations, individuals grow old and die of something. So what makes a genetically healthy population? So when I teach the vet students at Cornell about genetic population health, I always show them the example of the Yakutian horse. So one of the coldest inhabited places in the world is the province of Yakutia in Siberia, with recorded temperatures reaching as low as 70 degrees centigrade below zero, and typical wintertime lows of negative 40 degrees. And it doesn't matter whether you say centigrade or Fahrenheit when it's negative 40 degrees, it's that cold. The region was settled by the Yakut people in the 14th century, who brought their steppe horses with them. And over time, both the people and these horses became more and more adapted to the harsh climates of Siberia. Because the horses they brought with them were genetically diverse, there was a lot of raw genetic material for natural selection to work with. So many of the horses surely died at first during the coldest nights, but over time, the horses with the variants that conferred adaptation to this cold environment survived and reproduced. The horses evolved into their own breed with a stout and woolly look that thrives in the harsh environment. And genetic analysis shows evidence of selective sweeps in several key genes related to cold adaptation, including thick hair and shivering. And many of these same genes also showed signatures of selection in woolly mammoths. Both the Yakutian horses and the ancestral steppe horses that were their ancestors were well adapted to the environment and genetically healthy. Most natural populations are well adapted to their environment due to natural selections. Say survival of the fittest, and breeders strive to create breeds that are well adapted to their environment and purpose. But genetic health of a population is more than just being able to survive in an environment and fulfill a role. A genetically healthy population must also be able to maintain its fitness by being able to keep harmful mutations at low frequency and prevent them from dragging down the fitness of future generations. A population with too small of what we call an effective population size is not genetically healthy and will eventually suffer from these harmful mutations. We call these harmful mutations the genetic load in a population. And while I won't get too far in the details about how genetic load is calculated and different types of genetic load, the important thing to know is that in large populations, harmful mutations are kept at low frequency and eventually weeded out. So the genetic load in these populations is generally lower than in small populations where selection is less effective and drift enables harmful mutations to reach higher frequencies. But even in populations that are large enough to avoid accumulating a severe genetic load, even these populations are at risk if they don't have enough genetic variation. Environments are variable. Climates can change, new predators can emerge, new pathogens can evolve. Domestic dog breeds also face these risks, along with sometimes changes in the needs and wants of humans. Because the steppe horses of the 14th century were a genetically healthy population, they could evolve and adapt to one of the harshest environments in the world. Do you think if we brought today's thoroughbred horses to Yakut, they would eventually evolve into something similar? Frankly, I don't think they'd make it past the first Christmas. Thoroughbreds are fast horses that are great at what they do, but this selective breeding has eroded away most of their genetic diversity, and so they would have a much more difficult time of adapting to new environments than other more genetically diverse horse populations. This need for raw genetic variation is so important that R.A. Fisher developed the fundamental theorem of natural selection around it a century ago. He derived that the rate of increase in fitness of any organism at any time is equal to its genetic variance in fitness at that time and the strength of natural selection acting upon it. If you want to improve a characteristic, racing speed, endurance, trainability, noise tolerance, disease resistance, anything, you have to select for it. Hoping isn't enough. You need to actively select to improve that characteristic, and you need to have genetic variation in your population that you can select upon. The more genetic variation you start with and the harder you select for the character, the faster the rate of genetic improvement you're going to see for that character. In fact, this is the essential essence of the modern breeder's equation, which measures the rate of genetic improvement of a population per year and also includes terms for the accuracy of the phenotypic measurements or predictions in the generation interval. So in both of these equations, the more genetic variation you have in the population, the more rapid genetic adaptation you're going to see in that population under selection. Genetically healthy populations, by definition, must be adaptable and must therefore have sufficient genetic variation to be adaptable. Over the past 65 years, the amount of milk produced annually per dairy cow has more than doubled, from 13,000 pounds to 28,000 pounds, with most of this improvement coming from the improvement in the genetics of the Holstein cattle themselves. This is a direct result of the massive pedigree and phenotype databases built by the U.S. cattle industry and the devotion to using the breeder's equation to improve the milk yield and net merit of each cow over time. This was an extraordinarily difficult undertaking. How does one even phenotype milk yield in a bull to determine which bulls will pass along the best genes? The answer is progeny testing, and it's slow and it's an expensive undertaking. In 2009, 4 years after the dog genome was published, the cattle genome was published. And now in both dogs and cattle, this enabled the development of genotyping arrays, shown here on the right, for genetic research and for genetic testing. And in both species, over 1 million animals are tested annually using these platforms. Now in dogs, the majority of these tests are sold to pet owners looking to discover the breed mix of their shelter dog, although breeders make up a significant fraction of the market and are increasingly using the tests to improve breeding decisions and manage genetic diversity. In dairy cattle, however, these genetic tests are being amassed alongside phenotypic records that lead to unprecedented rates of genetic gain. With these massive data sets, ranchers don't need to wait for bulls to grow up and progeny testing to be complete to estimate a phenotype. They can accurately use genetics to predict phenotypes and assign net merit to each cow and bull. In this way, the generation interval is reduced. You don't have to wait to measure all of this in the progeny to decide that you have an elite bull. And this leads to faster rates of genetic gain. As data sets get larger and predictive accuracy improves, the rate of gain only gets faster. Dairy cattlemen have already invested extensively in using pedigrees and phenotyping to improve milk yield, feed efficiency, other desirable traits, and now they've gone on to invest $100 million in the first decade to implement genomic selection. And this has led to a $4 billion return on that investment. A bull born today is almost $90 more valuable on average than one born last year, $180 more valuable than one born 2 years ago, $900 more valuable than one born a decade ago. The rate of genetic improvement has only accelerated since genomic selection was adopted by the breeders. And with this rate of gain, it's mostly coming from the ability to accurately predict phenotypes in young bulls and cows, enabling for reduced generation times in the breeding program. This strong selection and reduced generation time is not without a cost. Levels of inbreeding, whether calculated genetically or from pedigree records, have noticeably increased, and this rate of increase has also increased as generation times have shortened. This increase in inbreeding has had a noticeable impact on the health of individuals. If we look at reproductive success in female Holstein cattle, we can see clearly over the past decade the impact of inbreeding depression. If we model the variables that influence the probability a female will last three calving seasons in the herd, so this is the top plot, we'll see the effect of inbreeding is quite pronounced in both of the models the researchers constructed, M1 and M2. In both of these models, outbred cows had around a 50% chance of staying in the herd for three calving seasons, while those with 30 to 40% inbreeding coefficients had only around a 35% chance. Similarly, the bottom plot shows the probabilities of staying in the herd for four calving seasons, and here the probability drops from around 30% to about 15% in the inbred cows. So what are strategies for minimizing inbreeding depression? So the first is called minimum kinship breeding, where we try to find individuals that are the most genetically distinct in a population and use them preferentially in a breeding program. Again, this can be done with pedigrees, but it's best done using genomics. If all the individuals in a population are genotyped, you can calculate the kinship coefficient between each pair of individuals. So for the EMBARK test, this would be essentially finding the individuals with the lowest average litter COIs when compared to all the other individuals in the breeding population. You would then preferentially use those individuals in the breeding program so that their rare genetics are retained in the population. Obviously, you'd want to try to cross them out to minimize litter COIs as well, although there's a caveat to this. And the caveat is that in many populations, including purebred dogs, there's population structure, and we don't want to necessarily destroy the uniqueness of each line by constantly outcrossing between the lines. We, of course, want the ability to outcross when needed, but we also want subpopulations that have been shaped for particular environments or roles to keep their distinctiveness. So we should consider the overall diversity in the breed and not let rare lineages go extinct, but we also don't want to necessarily push to completely minimize COI in every single cross if that means all the distinct lines in the breed are going to become homogenized over time. Sometimes a population has so little genetic diversity left, outcrossing is the only hope, but usually such extreme outcrossing is not needed or desirable. Now, in cattle breeding, they're developing complex mathematical equations that enable the short-term goals of rapid genetic gain to be tempered and balanced with the long-term goals of maintaining genetic diversity. So the key insight is that you can set the desired level of inbreeding or genetic diversity loss at some level, and then mathematically you can optimize your genetic gain by allocating offspring to high merit parents in the breeding program. So theoretically, if you didn't care about genetic diversity loss at all, you would only breed your very, very best bulls. But this popular sire effect quickly erodes the genetic diversity in your breed. On the other end of the spectrum, you can practice minimum kinship breeding to optimize diversity and get no genetic gain. Fortunately, you can generally maintain long-term diversity with minimal inbreeding and still achieve fast rates of genetic gain with optimum contribution selection, where the best bulls and cows are allocated several offspring and other high-merit individuals are allocated one or two. These high-merit individuals can then be actually paired, usually using a mating allocation strategy that minimizes inbreeding. Now, DNA, of course, doesn't care about whether it's in a dairy cow or a pedigreed dog. It's going to respond to the same selection principles in the same way. But the way the dairy cattle industry is structured in managing their herds is not really a practical or desirable way to manage dog breeding. So first of all, I don't think any of us has $100 million sitting around to develop the infrastructure that the dairy cattlemen have developed, nor do we have anyone managing a million head of dog that can make a centralized breeding decision and get responses to selection like this. So this is merely an illustration of how to think about optimizing breeding decisions and how it relates to concepts we already know from dog breeding, such as not relying too much on popular sires. All right, so I want to talk about a few other examples. I think there's some illustrative points to be made with these examples of species that have undergone severe bottlenecks. I believe we're all familiar with the story of the American bison. So we had 30 to 60 million bison living in North America when the European colonists first arrived to the New World. And then in a historically unprecedented, relentless persecution of the bison, we had all but an eventual complete loss, and we went down to about 100 breeding animals. The home range contracted as hunting pressure intensified until only a single wild population remained by 1890. But importantly, five isolated populations were also maintained on ranches. This population crash from tens of millions of buffalo to less than 100 in the span of a century certainly left a genetic imprint on the bison genome today. There is significantly less genetic diversity in today's bison, and they're not out of the woods yet, but their numbers have rebounded to over 20,000 wild bison. And importantly, these wild bison only represent 4% of the bison in North America. There's nearly 500,000 bison that are raised by ranchers, and they've created a profitable market for bison products, especially bison meat. So a key to the bison's survival was that they had multiple captive lines maintained by the ranchers. So each line, if maintained in isolation, would have suffered from inbreeding depression, like what happened to the passenger pigeon at about the same time, where only a single colony was saved going into the 20th century and it died out pretty quickly from inbreeding depression. But there were multiple buffalo lines, and so the rare deleterious alleles in each population were different. And so through outcrossing and backcrossing, purging of these deleterious alleles could take place. And it probably also helped a little bit that the ranchers also maintained cattle. And because cattle and bison can interbreed, although there's F1 hybrid inviability, or at least the males are sterile, the cattle genes did sneak into the bison during this time, restoring a little bit of genetic diversity. And even the wild bison in Yellowstone today have about 2.5% cattle ancestry. A surprising fact about natural populations is their resilience to population crashes. So even a sustained population crash can be survivable because there can be genetic purging of deleterious recessive alleles that are exposed to natural selection in small populations. So if we look at this population crash here, where you have a population with an effective size of about 1,000 breeding individuals suddenly go down to this really small population of just 10 individuals, we see the mean fitness in the population drops pretty rapidly, pretty steadily. But instead of continuing to drop to zero after about 20 generations, it stabilizes and even increases a little bit because a lot of these deleterious recessives have been exposed through inbreeding and have gotten purged from the population. So overall, natural selection is not as effective in this small population as it was in the large population. But given a benign enough environment and local adaptation or a lack of direct competition with a larger source population, these small island populations are quite capable of surviving and adapting. Often a bottleneck is followed by a period of exponential growth, such as when a few animals colonize a new island or habitat. And in this case, the relatively low fitness is not a problem for the population because every individual on average is leaving multiple offspring due to exponential growth. And this gives the population even more resilience and time to eventually purge the most deleterious variants and adapt to the local environment. So Channel Island foxes are a classic example of populations that sustain themselves despite small effective population sizes. These small islands off the Southern California coast are an ideal habitat for the foxes. The fox population, each island is quite small, just hundreds of foxes, and there's little migration between the islands, but they're not completely separated. As you might expect, the foxes have much less heterozygosity than mainland foxes, but nevertheless, they're thriving on the islands, and they have been for millennia. The main cause of death in these foxes is not inherited disorders, it's car accidents. Genetic purging over the centuries has removed the worst of the deleterious variants and enabled these foxes to live with a relatively low genetic load. Dingoes are another example of a successful introduction after a severe bottleneck. So this is a picture of Sandy, a dingo whose genome was assembled in 2022. Dingoes are descended from Southeast Asian village dogs. They arrived in Australia around 4,500 years ago. The number of dingoes that colonized the continent was quite small. So if you graph out the mitochondrial haplotype diversity in dogs for the A haplogroup, you can see that all the dingoes are clustered together around the A29 haplotype, or they're just one mutation away. So this is kind of consistent with a single family of dingoes, perhaps just one pregnant male arriving to Australia about 4,500 years ago. But despite this exceedingly strong bottleneck, the population underwent exponential growth and colonized much of Australia. Dingoes have more homozygosity than village dogs or wolves, but their genetic load overall is not significantly elevated. The various dingo populations in Australia all have a few more homozygous damaging mutations than village dogs or wolves, but they also have fewer heterozygous ones overall. So they clearly survived the original founder bottleneck and were able to flourish on the continent for millennia. So dingoes and Channel Island foxes give us hope about the genetic fate of modern dog breeds, but it's important to recognize that the forces of selection acting on these populations are quite different from those acting on purebred dogs. There is strong natural selection in these populations. Foxes and dingoes must be able to find food, avoid predators, give birth naturally, raise offspring, survive environmental calamities, survive disease outbreaks. Generation after generation, only the fittest survive and reproduce. In contrast, purebred dogs are not under such selection for these traits, and so it's the intense selection that allows for the purging of these deleterious recessive alleles from the isolated populations. So breeders need to try to be as selective as nature. If they're not, you can't expect to see genetic purging acting in the same way to maintain the long-term genetic health of the breed. And so generally, you're facing trade-offs if you're trying to select for other attributes. You know, obviously, it's important to select for conformation, but if you select too much for one thing like coat color, you're going to erode your ability to select for genetic health and purge out deleterious alleles. In the modern era, breeders have many tools at their disposal to make informed breeding decisions, including carrier testing and tests to determine how much inbreeding will be caused by different pairings. And these tests are important, but ultimately for the long-term survival of the breed, ensuring that the healthiest animals are bred generation after generation is the only way that selection can maintain genetic health in the isolated populations. So the best practice I would say to breeders is that they should be monitoring COI, and all else being equal, show a preference for lower litter COI matings. But that's just one of the many aspects to a breeding decision that need to be weighed. Our goal is to maintain the genetic health and distinctiveness of the breed overall, and it's to produce healthy litters. It's not to drive COI to zero or even minimize it with strict minimum kinship breeding generation after generation. In most breeds, it's more important to maintain distinct lines than it is to homogenize them. Yes, breeders should occasionally consider crossing between lines to inject genetic diversity into them, but we shouldn't always cross, or pretty soon we'll run out of distinctive lines. And then what are we going to cross to? By monitoring COI and health, we can make informed decisions about injecting diversity into a line throughout crossing. And finally, to the extent that the goal of preservation breeding is to preserve what you have, not to achieve the most rapid genetic gain possible, use the breeder equation to your advantage and lengthen the generation interval to slow down the loss of genetic diversity. Store semen from young dogs and then use it later from the best ones, rather than retaining offspring from a bitch's first litter for a breeding program, adopt them out, and prefer offspring from later litters for breeding. These simple steps, along with the common sense techniques for increasing effective population size, things like avoiding popular sires and increasing the overall number of breeding animals, will slow the loss of genetic diversity over time in a breed, and will also give breeders a more complete picture of the overall health and merit of each individual before it contributes to their breeding program. In conclusion, we've learned a lot about genetics and COI, a measure that's been around since pedigrees were invented and which is something that has only grown to be more powerful now that we have visibility into the genomes of individuals and can calculate actual COI based on genetics. It is, I feel, an important tool for minimizing inbreeding depression and maintaining genetic diversity, but it's not the only tool breeders should be using, and it's certainly not the overriding consideration for breeders to use to make breeding decisions. Small differences in expected litter COI are not usually meaningful, and there's some desirability to maintaining some distinctiveness across lines that would be destroyed if we insisted on absolute minimum COIs generation after generation. Whew! Hopefully I left time for questions. I appreciate everybody's interest in this pair of webinars and look forward to hearing from you. Thanks.
Amazing. Thank you so much. This was such an amazing presentation. We do have quite a bit of questions, so I'm going to do my best to either synthesize some of them or just get through them quickly. So we had one question come in about conservation geneticists and how they think about dog breeds differently than the average breeder might. What do you think breeders can learn from the perspective of conservation geneticists?
So conservation geneticists have gone through a litany of genetic tools because typically they don't have pedigrees to work with. And, you know, they started out using STRs and now they've all pretty much migrated over to SNP-based platforms or whole genome sequencing kinds of things. And I think one of the common missteps that happened in some conservation programs was that in an effort to maintain outcrossing and maintain as much genetic diversity as possible, not enough effort was put into seeing whether they were actually looking at distinct subpopulations that maybe shouldn't get mixed together. And, you know, sometimes like a species is so far gone, like Galapagos tortoises, you can't possibly maintain distinct lines on different islands anymore. You just have to keep the genetic diversity you have, and that's the best you can do. But, you know, there's certainly cases with like African painted dogs and things like that, where there are distinct subpopulations within Africa that you don't necessarily notice at first. But then when you look at the genetics, you, oh yeah, but now you've kind of homogenize those lines together in the zoo population and, you know, maybe less than ideal.
Thank you for answering that one. We did get a ton of questions about eliminating disease variants without losing diversity. So someone asked, what's the right way to think about removing a disease variant from a breed without inadvertently shrinking the gene pool further? I feel like that's a juggle a lot of breeders face.
Yeah. So I think for the most part, most of the diseases we can test for are recessive disorders. And so with a recessive disorder, the goal isn't to rapidly remove the disease allele from the population, particularly if that disease allele has an appreciable carrier frequency, right? So if half of the individuals in the population are carriers, and you don't consider carriers for breeding, you've just lost half of your genetic diversity. And when, you know, you're not only eliminating that genetic defect from the population, you're also removing all of the diversity throughout the genome that those individuals carry. And so, especially if you have a genetic test for it, what you want to do is you want to use the genetic test just to make sure you don't cross carriers to carriers. But you want to retain the rest of the genetic diversity that those carriers have. And only very slowly do you start to replace some of the breeding carriers with equally strong non-carriers. You know, and for some, obviously you can't breed away from HUU. If it's fixed, you got to do something else. I mean, with CRISPR, we're going to have other options in the near future with some of this. But even if it's at a high frequency, there's some traits that are at over 90% frequency in some breeds. It's going to be too much of a bottleneck if you just breed down rapidly from that. You really have to take a measured approach.
And then just a follow-up to that one, how should breeders weigh removing carriers entirely versus breeding carriers that are carefully bred with, like, clear-tested males? How should they weigh that?
I mean, I would definitely encourage continued breeding of high-quality carriers to clear dogs. I mean, we should be at the day and age where all of the breeding animals, if not all of the litters too, are getting genetically tested. So you're not saving yourself money from genetic testing. What you're doing if you don't breed the carriers is you're trading a genetic defect that you know about and you can test for and you can never create an effective individual from with unknown defects that these clear dogs maybe have that are going to increase in frequency. You know, you're basically creating a popular sire for clear males right now, but you don't know what else those males have. And so that's sort of the situation you want to avoid.
Yeah.
I mean, if it's the carrier frequency is less than 1%, it's not really that big of a deal. You're not losing a lot of genetic diversity. But, you know, when you have appreciable carrier frequencies in the line, you don't want to just rapidly eliminate the carriers. Otherwise, the ultimate result of developing that genetic test is to make the breed less healthy because there's now less diversity in the breed. And that's right. What we want to avoid.
Shifting gears a little bit to looking forward to the future of tools and what they can tell breeders. So for breeders who have been using DNA panels for years, I'm curious what the next layer to you of genomic information is that they should be paying attention to.
So the great thing about using the DNA information over the years is that now you have a way to track changes. Are you seeing an increase in any of the disease alleles? And is there a reason for that? Do we need to worry about that? Are you seeing an increase in COIs for new litters? Rather than saying, you know, oh, we just started testing with a SNP platform and our average COI on our breed was this number, so that's bad. I would say, well, if you're not seeing a lot of inbreeding depression in your breed, the number in and of itself isn't bad if it's not increasing. But if that number is increasing over time, now you have limited genetic diversity and it's eroding away, let's do something before it becomes even more of a crisis. You know, that's how I would say to use it. Like being able to use it to monitor so that you can make informed decisions rather than sort of crisis in the moment reactive decisions or waiting too long, right?
Right.
So my hobby is I'm a private pilot. Ithaca has a fantastic airport.
Oh, flying, very right? Cool.
And the first thing you learn when you're trying to land a plane is that always pay attention to what's going on and monitor changes. Because if you can catch that change early, it's a really small input you need to correct it. But if you continue on autopilot for too long, all of a sudden you've got to have a really big influx of power or drag or something in order to correct it, and you might crash the plane. And I think managing populations are the same way.
Yeah, definitely. Well, speaking of managing populations, I think we had so many breeders join these two webinars who are coming from just very rare breeds, or maybe we would call it like a genetically bottlenecked breed. For those breeders, they're really looking, I guess, to hear your advice on what realistic options exist for improving diversity over time when they really are just, they feel like they have everything working against them with their breed.
Right. I mean, this isn't a webinar about when do we have to genetically rescue breeds. I mean, do we ever want to outcross in breeds? Do we have to outcross breeds? I mean, I think the high level is there gets to be a point where a population has lost so much genetic diversity, really outcrossing is the only way to try to manage that. Most dog breeds are not there. Like if you look at conservation genetics and you look at what the effective population size is for short-term survival and long-term survival, most dog breeds have enough individuals that if they're well managed, they can survive in the long term. But using the tools at our disposal like COI and thinking about what breeding decisions mean not only for the next litter but for the long-term health of the breed, taking those into account is going to help us maintain those populations.
Awesome. I see one from Tim who's asking if we shouldn't be striving for a zero COI, then what's the ideal percentage window we should be striving for?
So I think it's going to be different for different breeds, right? So, you know, you have some breeds that just fixed more of their genome than other breeds did during this whole, we founded the breed and we set up and we developed the breed, right? And I think that's kind of the baseline that you would then strive for, with the caveat that if you happen to fix anything deleterious like HUU, then we should develop a strategy for getting that out of the line at some point, right? I know people just want to like have me give a range, right? Like this is healthy, this is unhealthy.
Yeah.
And like it doesn't quite work that way. You know your breed better than anybody else. Hopefully you're monitoring, you're seeing what is the range of COIs I'm seeing in my breed. Am I seeing an increase in health problems at these higher COI levels? So normally I would just say you're trying to push pairings that are going to reduce the overall COI on average, but you're not insisting on, you know, minimum kinship relationships in order to breed. Like you have other breeding considerations that are going on. I mean, I think just that, like taking genetic COI into account before you start assigning pairings and preferring the outcrossed ones, as long as it still meets with your, I want to keep this line distinct from that line and that kind of stuff. If doing that reduces your average COI from 0.4 to 0.3, I think that's going to result in a meaningful difference in the health of the dogs. And it's not clear that trying to drive down the minimum COI in the breed generation after generation is going to have the same kind of response. And in fact, you may inadvertently wind up selecting for rare variants that were rare because they weren't good, right? So There's a little bit of danger there in pushing too hard on it.
So this next one might kind of warrant a similar answer. It looks like Jen is wondering how many individual gene samples from a rare breed are needed to get an accurate genetic COI to use properly in a population. So this might be one of those same scenarios where there isn't an exact number to share, but maybe I'm wrong.
Yeah, I mean, if it's a rare breed, then, you know, I think it's really important to try to test as many individuals in that breed as possible, because you don't know who is carrying a rare haplotype, right? And in a rare breed, a rare haplotype is probably only in one or two individuals. And so then it becomes more important to include that individual in the breeding program. And that's why calculating this mean kinship or this mean, you know, litter COI statistic to identify those individuals carrying genetic diversity that would be lost if they're not bred is so important, because then you can include that information when you're making your breeding decisions in order to not have those haplotypes go extinct.
Awesome. I think that might be all of the chat questions we have time for, but I did want to end on one that it's actually my question, but I thought everyone could benefit from it. What's one thing that you wish every breeder walks away from this presentation and the one before that, understanding about population genetics that maybe is very misunderstood typically by breeders? It gets lost in conversation. I guess, how would you wrap up all of this in kind of a bow that you wish all breeders walk away from this?
Well, with? I guess, I mean, we always want to make informed scientific decisions. And I think it's really great when tools get developed and they actually get put in the hands of real people and they can make kind of informed decisions. But there's always the, when you assign a number to something, people tend to fixate on that number and maybe over-index on it because it's something that does have a number assigned to it. And there's other aspects that are maybe more subjective, but that doesn't mean that they're not important. And so I would say it is great to use COI as a tool so that in general, you know, am I creating lower COI litters or am I creating higher COI litters? But you don't want that tool to become your brain and be the thing that you're obsessed on in the breeding decision. It's just one tool that you're consulting. You know, like a lower BMI is better than a higher BMI, right? But there are limitations to the BMI, you know, statistic, right? Like if I lose a leg, my BMI goes down. That doesn't make me any healthier. If I lose two legs, my BMI actually goes up because I'm shorter, but that doesn't make me, you know? So you don't want to over-index on something just because it has a number, but it's still useful, right? And so that would be what my take-home message is.
I love that. Thank you for sharing that. I think that's a perfect note to kind of end this series on. We can't thank you enough for doing this for us. I think I speak on behalf of the community when I say everyone was so interested and engaged and really loved everything you had to share with us. So we just thank you so much again for taking the time.
Great. Thank you, everybody, for joining.
Of course. Thank you all so much again for joining. As a reminder, if you're not yet part of our community, you can do so at gooddog.com/join, so you can apply to join us. And just to leave everyone with a preview of our next webinar, because they're still coming really quickly into the summer. We have our next one on Wednesday, June 10th at 1 p.m. Eastern, and that's with Dr. Candace Crony, who hasn't joined us for a very long time, but we love Dr. Crony. We've done some work with her years ago, and she'll be presenting on raising a socially well-adjusted puppy. So total gear shift from what we've been covering here, but we're really excited about that. And as a reminder, I know everyone's going to ask, this was all recorded. We'll have part one of this and part two recorded and shared in our newsletter with everyone, so look out for that. And until then, thank you all so much again for being here, and we'll see you at our next webinar. Bye, everyone. Thank you.
Thanks, Nicole.